I'd like to speak about four things this evening. I'd like to speak about the monastic archetype. Then I'd like to speak about my particular tradition. Then about my particular vocation, how I came to be a Benedictine nun. And finally, I'd like to talk about spiritual formation. First of all, the monastic archetype. It's obvious that monasticism is a worldwide phenomenon. You find Buddhist monks and nuns, Hindu ascetics, the Taoist hermits of China, the Sufi brotherhoods, and Christian monastic life. And so it's not wrong to say that monastic life, in a sense, is prior to the gospel. For whatever reason, there's some instinct in the human heart which some persons have chosen to live out in a deliberate and continual and lifetime way, a life of total consecration to spiritual practice and so forth. And I remember reading in the New York Times book review a number of years ago, a review of Burton's poems, and the reviewer, in an excellent review, ended it by saying this, that one thing about this guy, Merton, is that he made an extreme life option seem reasonable. And I thought that was a wonderful comment about monastic life, that it is an extreme life option. The normal way is the life of the householder. The way of the monk is the exception. And yet, I think that there is a monastic dimension to every human heart, that sense of the absolute, that sense of a preoccupation with the ultimate and what that means and so forth. But that has been lived out and concretized historically in various of the major religious traditions of humankind. So, Chadran and I are here this evening to speak to you and share with you about our own experience in our traditions as women monastics and what monastic life means. I'd like to say something about my own particular tradition. I am a Roman Catholic Benedictine, and I love my tradition very much. In fact, I think any good Buddhist would tell me that I'm far too attached. But maybe a little mania like that creates some success, I don't know. But I remember a sister from an order telling me one time about 10, 15 years ago, well, maybe we should just finish with all these orders in the church and have just one group called the American Sisters. I said, that's fine. As long as everybody wants to be Benedictines, that's fine. So the Benedictine order is the oldest monastic order of the West, in a sense. St. Benedict is the patron of Europe and the father of Western monasticism. And he's called the father of Western monasticism because 2.5 centuries of monastic life and experience happened before him. And he is, to some extent, the channel, the conduit through which the earlier tradition, the Desert Fathers, John Cassian, Evagrius, and so forth, that spirituality was then channeled through southern France, through Gaul, and Benedict, and the source that he primarily used, the Rule of the Master, is a distillation of much of that 2.5 centuries of monastic experience and exploration. But what Benedict added was a kind of pure gospel rendering and a providing of a form of monastic life that was the via media, was a way of moderation between extremes. It was a livable form of monastic life. And so it was created just at the time that the Roman Empire was crumbling. And Benedict's monastic life, his monasteries, became a backbone of Western civilization. As you know, the monks saved much of classical culture and manuscripts and so forth. And so the centuries from the 6th to the 12th century are frequently called by historians the Benedictine centuries. So Benedictus represents that kind of mainline monastic life. Both men and women have been have existed in monastic life, Benedictine monastic life, from the beginning, because St. Benedict was a twin. He had a twin sister named St. Scholastica, who had a convent nearby his monastery. And even when the Benedictines finally were sent by Augustine the Pope, Pope St. Gregory the Great, St. Augustine, to England, Benedictine nuns were established very early on the Isle of Thanet off of England. So women and men, you know, this male and female branch of the order have existed right from the beginning in the Benedictine tradition. In fact, that's true of the older religious orders in the Catholic Church. The Franciscans and Dominicans both have male and female branches, okay? So as far as I know, there are no female Jesuits yet. Except that that's not true because many of the modern orders are very Ignatian in their spirit, but I'm kidding. All right, to say a little bit about the Benedictine way of life. The key to understanding the Benedictine way of life is that it's a balanced life of prayer, work, and study. And Benedict had the genius to provide a kind of balanced daily rhythm of certain hours for prayer in common, the divine office, the liturgical prayer, and times for private prayer, times for study, mostly called Lectio Divina, a spiritual reading of the sacred texts, and time for work. And the Benedictine motto is ora et labora, prayer and work, although some people say it's prayer and work, work, work. But it's a key to the success of the Benedictine tradition, I think, is that it has lasted for 15 centuries because of a common sense, because of an emphasis on gospel values. Benedict had a great sensitivity for the old and the young, the infirm, the pilgrim. One whole chapter of the rule is on hospitality, the reception of guests, and so on. One of the ways the Benedictine motto has been described is that it's the love of learning and the desire of God. And the Benedictines have a great love of learning and a sense of culture. And they have a great tradition of scholarship and so forth. Women have been very important in the Benedictine tradition. Women like St. Gertrude and Hildegard of Bingen, who has really been sort of rediscovered in the last 5-10 years in our times, are very important and always important in the Benedictine tradition. And when I was talking with Chodron today, we were talking about transmission and lineage and so forth. And though we in the West don't have a master to disciple kind of lineage that you do, for example, in the East, in the monasteries, we do have a kind of subtle transmission, a spirit that carries over generation to generation. I can think of one abbey in England, for example, of Benedictine nuns, who have a style of prayer which is quite unique, and they trace it back 4 centuries to Augustine Baker, a great spiritual writer. And that's passed on person to person in that monastery. So monasteries are great reservoirs of spiritual power and spiritual knowledge in the tradition, okay? A priceless resource in the tradition. Say something about how I personally became a Benedictine nun. I trace my vocation back to when I was in the 8th grade, my paternal grandmother died quite suddenly of a heart attack, and it all of a sudden confronted me with the question, what is the purpose of human existence? What is it all about? And I remember very clearly thinking, either God exists and everything makes sense, or God does not exist and nothing makes sense. And I thought, well, if God exists, then it makes sense to live entirely in terms of that. And though I was not going to a Catholic school, I did not know any nuns, any sisters. In a sense, that was the beginning of my vocation, because I thought, yes, God exists, and I'm going to live entirely in terms of that. And then a few years later in high school, I began to perceive a distinct call towards religious life and Benedictine life in particular. And it was the same time that I felt a kind of rising of a desire for prayer and a contact with that divine reality. Though I was a kind of normal kid, you know, going to Sunday Mass, not everyday Mass, but Sunday Mass, I really didn't have much of a spirituality. And so all of a sudden, this confrontation with death brought me to the question of what's the purpose of human existence. I entered a Benedictine community in Minnesota, an active Benedictine community that did teaching, nursing, and social work back in 1959, like the kid that I entered when I was at 7 years old. So it's been more than 30 years now that I've been a Benedictine. And I think it is a great grace and a wonderful experience. I have no regrets at all. It's been a wonderful journey. But right in the beginning of my monastic life in Minnesota, I was teaching besides living monastic life, and I felt I really want to concentrate on my spiritual practice. I felt a call to what is called contemplative life. And I didn't know how I would live this out, and I taught high school for 6 years. Then I came east to study at Fordham, and I studied with Alice McDowell at Fordham. And increasingly, I began to sense that that was the right thing to do, but a long story, I taught at St. Louis University in St. Louis for 3 years, and then I knew two sisters who were already in Syracuse and intending to start a foundation from scratch in the Diocese of Syracuse. And I asked my community in Minnesota for permission to come, and I decided, well, maybe I should visit before I come. And in 1978, I drove from St. Louis to New York City, and I stopped in Syracuse. On the Feast of the Transfiguration, 1978, I drove from Syracuse to New York City. The sisters had no idea where they were going to be in the Diocese of Syracuse, but on the way to New York, I was almost out of gas, and I pulled into a little town, Windsor, and as I drove down the main street, I said to myself, well, it'd be nice to live in a small town like this. 6 months later, I got a letter from Sister Jean Marie saying that they had bought property in the southern tier of New York near Binghamton, about 15 miles east, and I had a funny feeling that I remembered what town that was, and sure enough, it was Windsor. So I think the hand of God has been clearly, you know, guiding me along the way, and even specifically to Windsor. So after teaching graduate school at St. Louis for 3 years, I've now been at Windsor starting a community from scratch, which is quite a challenge. And our aim is to return to a classical Benedictine lifestyle, very close to the earth, with great solitude and simplicity and silence. And hospitality is a very important part of our life. So we have two guest houses. And we are four nuns, and we hope to grow, you know, not to be an immense community, but we hope to grow and receive new members. And we have a young sister now who's a very, very talented icon painter. One of the privileges that I've had within the order is that for 8 years, 6 years, 8 years, I was on a committee of both Benedictines and Trappists, monks and nuns, who were commissioned by the Vatican to begin dialogue with Buddhist and Hindu monks and nuns. Back in the mid-70s, Vatican Secretariat that dialogued with the other religions, major religions of the world, said that monks should take a leading role in this because monasticism is a worldwide phenomenon. So for 8 years, I had the privilege of being on a committee that began the dialogue in the United States with Hindu and Buddhist monks and nuns, and we sponsored even visits of some of the Tibetan monks to American monasteries. And I was sent as a representative to the Third Asian Monastic Conference in Kandy, Sri Lanka in 1980. Merton died at the First Asian Monastic Conference. So this was a meeting of Christian monastics in Asia who had as our focus for that meeting poverty and simplicity of life, but also the question of dialogue with the other traditions. Just to end by saying a few things about how I understand the spiritual life in general. What is spirituality all about? To me, spirituality, the spiritual life, comes down to one word. It's transformation. The path, the marga, is about transformation. It's about passage from our old self to the new self. From the path from ignorance to an enlightenment, the path from selfishness to greater charity. There are many ways that this can be talked about. Hinduism talks about the ahamkara, the superficial self, and then the deep self that one attains, the atman, through spiritual practice. Merton talked about the transition, the passage from the false self to our true identity in God. And I'm not saying that all of these are identical, but they're certainly analogous, even homologous, okay? The Sufi tradition talks about the necessity of the disintegration of the old self, fana, and baka, the reintegration in a deeper spiritual self. Tibetan Buddhism has talked about the Vajra self. And Teresa of Avila in The Interior Castle, when she talks about going inward to the center of her soul, through steps and phases of spiritual practice, she said, I came to the center of my soul, where I saw my soul blazing up like a diamond. And so the symbol of the diamond, the Vajra, is a universal or archetype of spiritual transformation. The diamond is luminous, light shines through it, and yet it's indestructible. But it's the result of a transformation of intense pressure and intense heat. And all true spiritual transformation, I believe, is a result of intense pressure and intense heat. In the book of Revelation, chapter 22, there's a vision of the heavenly Jerusalem, which is the consummation of the cosmos or the consummation of our individual spiritual journey. And the writer of the book of Revelation says, I saw the vision of a city, a 12-gated city, which is a mandala. And in the center was the throne with the Lamb on it, the Father, Son, and a river of life flowing in four directions, the Holy Spirit. Okay, I'm giving you the Christian Trinitarian interpretation. Okay, but that, again, the waters were crystal or diamond-like, the author of the book of Revelation says. And so that light of grace of God, of the divine, of the ultimate that transforms us is that crystal-like, diamond-like luminosity that shines through us. We chose at Windsor to name the monastery of the Transfiguration, because we believe that monastic persons are called to be transformed themselves in order to transform the cosmos, to transform not only ourselves, but the entire world, to let that light, that luminosity radiate out from us to all of creation. Another way that the Tibetan Buddhists talk about enlightenment is the intermarriage of wisdom and compassion, and I'd like to just say something about that. I've thought about that, and I may be stretching your meaning of it a little bit, but I think in each human being there's that tendency towards love and a tendency towards knowledge, okay? But I think those instincts in us, those basic urges for completion of love and of knowledge must be transformed. And that love is like the anima that must become animus. Knowledge is the animus which must become anima. And our knowledge must become wisdom by becoming loving. And our loving must become wise in order to be transformed. And I really believe that you can identify that process in all of the great paths of holiness, the inner marriage of wisdom and compassion. I haven't said much, perhaps, about women and women's experience, but I think we're going to get to that in the discussion, because we certainly had some good discussion about it today at the monastery around the table and then coming in the car up here also. So I think I'll turn it over to Chadun right now to have her tell you about her tradition and her experience.